Gunny, Breckinridge corrected. Everybody calls me Gunny. After it was all over, Ryan went on, I shook like a baby's rattle. Breckinridge was amused by this.
Hell, sir, we all do that. What counts is getting the job done. What comes after don't matter a damn. So what can I do for you, gentlemen? You want a few rounds of small bore practice?
Jackson explained what the FBI agent had said. The sergeant major's face darkened, the jaw set. After a moment, he shook his head. You're sweating this, huh?
Can't say that I blame you, Lieutenant.
Terrorists, he snorted. A terrorist is a punk with a machine gun. That's all. Just a well-armed punk. It doesn't take much to shoot somebody in the back or hose down an airport waiting room. So, Lieutenant, you'll be thinking about carrying some protection, right? And maybe something at home.
I don't know,
but I guess you're the man to see. Ryan hadn't thought about it yet, but it was clear that Robbie had. How do you do at Quantico?
I qualified with the .45 automatic and the M16. Nothing spectacular, but I qualified.
You do any shooting now, sir? Breckinridge asked with a frown. Just qualifying wasn't a very hopeful sign to a serious marksman.
I usually get my quota of ducks and geese. I missed out this season, though, Jack admitted.
Upland's game.
I had two good afternoons after dove in September. I'm a pretty fair wing shot, Gunny. I use a Remington 1100 automatic, 12-gauge.
Breckinridge nodded.
Good for a start. That's your at-home gun. Nothing beats a shotgun at close range. Short of a flamethrower, that is.
The sergeant major smiled. You have a deer slug barrel?
No?
Well, you're gonna get one of those. It's 20 inches or so, with a cylinder bore and rifle-type sights. You pull the magazine plug, and you got 5-round capacity. Now, most people will tell you to use double-aught buck, but I like number 4 better. More pellets, and you're not giving any range away. You can still hit out to 80-90 yards, and that's all you'll ever need. The important thing is, anything you hit with buckshot's going down. Period.
He paused. As a matter of fact, I might be able to get you some flechette rounds.
What's that? Ryan asked.
It's an experimental thing they're fooling with down at Quantico for military police use, and maybe at the embassies. Instead of lead pellets, you shoot 60 or so darts, about 3-caliber diameter, like little arrows. You gotta see what those little buggers do to believe it. Nasty. So that'll take care of home. Now you gonna want to carry a handgun with you?
Ryan thought about that. It would mean getting a permit. He thought he could apply to the state police for one. Or maybe to a certain federal agency. Already his mind was mulling over that question.
Maybe, he said finally. Okay. Let's do a little experiment.
Breckinridge walked into his office. He returned a minute later with a cardboard box.
Lieutenant, this here's a high-standard target pistol, a .22 built on a .45 frame.
The sergeant major handed it over. Ryan took it, ejected the magazine, and pulled the slide back to make sure the pistol was unloaded. Breckinridge watched and nodded approvingly. Jack had been taught range safety by his father 20 years before. After that, he fitted the weapon in his hand, then sighted down the range to get used to the feel. Every gun is a little different. This was a target pistol, with nice balance and pretty good sights.
Feels okay, Ryan said. Little lighter than a Colt, though.
This'll make it heavier. Breckinridge handed over a loaded clip. That's 5 rounds. Insert the clip in the weapon, but do not chamber a round until I tell you, sir. The sergeant major was accustomed to giving orders to officers and knew how to do so politely. Step to lane 4.
Relax. It's a nice day in the park, okay?
Yeah. That's how this whole mess started, Ryan observed wryly. The gunny walked over to the switch panel and extinguished most of the lights in the room.
Okay, Lieutenant. Let's keep the weapon pointed downrange and at the floor, if you please, sir.
Chamber your first round, and relax. Jack pulled the slide with his left hand, then let it snap forward. He didn't turn around. He told himself to relax and play the game. He heard a cigarette lighter snap shut. Maybe Robbie was lighting up one of his cigars.
I saw a picture of your little girl in the papers, Lieutenant. She's a pretty little thing.
Thank you, Gunny. I've seen one of yours on campus, too. Cute, but not very little. I heard she's engaged to a mid.
Yes, sir.
That's my little baby, Breckenridge said, like a father rather than a Marine. The last of my three. She'll be married.
Ryan nearly jumped out of his skin as a string of firecrackers began exploding at his feet. He started to turn when Breckenridge screamed at him.
There! There! There's your target!
A light snapped on to illuminate a silhouette target 50 feet away. One small part of Ryan's mind knew this was a test, but most of him didn't care. The 22 came up and seemed to aim itself at the paper target. He loosed all 5 rounds in under 3 seconds. The noise was still echoing when his trembling hands set the automatic down on the table.
Jesus Christ, Sergeant Major! Ryan nearly screamed.
The rest of the lights came back on. The room stank of gunpowder, and paper fragments from the firecrackers littered the floor. Robbie, Jack saw, was standing safely at the entrance to the gunny's office, while Breckenridge was right behind him, ready to grab Ryan's gun hand if he did anything foolish.
One of the other things I do is moonlight as an instructor for the Annapolis City Police. You know, it's a real pain in the ass trying to figure a way to simulate the stress of combat conditions. This here's what I came up with.
Okay, let's get a look at the target.
Breckenridge punched a button, and a hidden electric motor turned the pulley for lane 4.
Damn,
Ryan growled, looking at the target.
Not so bad, Breckenridge judged. We got 4 rounds on the paper. 2 snowbirds, 2 in the black, both in the chest. Your target is on the ground, Lieutenant, and he's hurt pretty bad.
2 rounds out of 5. Must be the last 2. I settled down on them and took some more time.
I noticed that.
Breckenridge nodded. Your first round was high and to the left, missed the card. Your next 2 came in here and here. The last 2 were on the money fairly well.
That's not too bad, Lieutenant.
I did a hell of a lot better in London.
Ryan was not convinced. The 2 holes outside the black target silhouette mocked at him, and 1 round hadn't even found the target at all.
In London, if the TV got it right, you had a second or 2 to figure out what you were going to do, the gunny said.
That's pretty much the way it was, Ryan admitted.
You see, Lieutenant, that's the real important part. That 1 or 2 seconds makes all the difference, because you have a little time to think things over. The reason so many cops get killed is because they don't have that little bit of time to think it out. But the crooks have done that already. That 1 second lets you figure what's happening, select your target, and decide what you're going to do about it. Now, what I just made you do was go through all 3 steps all at once. Your first round went wild. The 2nd and 3rd were better, and your last 2 were good enough to put the target on the ground. That's not bad, son. That's about as well as a trained cop does. But you gotta do better than that.
What do you mean?
A cop's job is to keep the peace. Your job is just staying alive, and that's a little easier. That's the good news. The bad news is, those bad guys ain't gonna give you 2 seconds to think unless you make 'em. Or you're real lucky.
Breckenridge waved for the men to follow him into his office. The sergeant major plopped down in his cheap swivel chair. Like Jackson, he was a cigar smoker. He lit up something better than what Robbie smoked, but it still stank up the room.
2 things you gotta do. 1, I want to see you here every day for a box of 22. That's every day for a month, Lieutenant. You have to learn to shoot better. Shooting is just like golf. You want to be good at it, you gotta do it every day. You have to work at it. And you need somebody to teach you right.
The gunny smiled.
That's no problem. I'll teach you right. The 2nd thing, you have to buy time for yourself if the bad guys come looking for you. The FBI told him to drive like the embassy guys do, Jackson offered.
Yeah, that's good for starters. Same as NNAM. You don't settle into patterns.
What if they try to hit you at home?
Pretty isolated, Gunny, Robbie said.
You got an alarm? Breckenridge asked Ryan.
No, but I can fix that pretty easy, Ryan said.
It's a good idea. I don't know the layout of your place, but if you can buy yourself a few seconds and you got that shotgun, Lieutenant, you can make them wish they never came calling. At least you can hold them off till the police come. Like I said, the name of the game's just staying alive.
Now what about your family?
My wife's a doc, and she's pregnant. My little girl... Well, you saw her on TV, I guess.
Does your wife know how to shoot?
I don't think she's ever touched a gun in her life.
I teach a class in firearm safety for women, part of the work I do with the local police.
Ryan wondered how Kathy would react to all this. He put that one off.
What sort of handgun you think I ought to get?
If you come by tomorrow, I'll try you out on a couple of them.
Mainly you want something you're comfortable with. Don't go out and get a 44 Magnum, okay?
I like automatics myself. The springs eat up a lot of the recoil, so they're easier to get comfortable with.
You want to buy something that's fun to shoot, not something that beats up on your hand and wrist.
Me, I like the 45 Colt, but I've been shooting that little baby for 20-some years.
Breckenridge grabbed Ryan's right hand and flexed it around roughly.
I think I'll start you off on a 9mm Browning. Your hand looks big enough to hold it, right? The Browning's got a 13-shot clip. You need a fair-sized hand to control it proper. Got a nice safety, too. If you have a kid in the house, Lieutenant, you'd better think about safety, okay?
No problem, Ryan said. I can keep it where she can't reach it. We got a big closet, and I can keep them there, 7 feet off the floor.
Can I practice with a big-bore handgun in here?
The sergeant major laughed.
That backstop we got used to be the armor plate on a heavy cruiser. Mainly we use 22s in here, but my guards practice with 45s all the time.
Sounds to me like you know shotgunning pretty good.
Once you have that skill with pistol too, you'll be able to do it with any gun you pick up.
Trust me, sir. This is what I do for a living.
When do you want me here?
Say about 4 every afternoon.
Ryan nodded.
Okay.
About your wife.
Look, just bring her over some Saturday, maybe. I'll sit her down and talk to her about guns. Lots of women, they're just afraid of the noise. And there's all that crap on TV. If nothing else, we'll get her used to shotgunning. You say she's a doc, so she's got to be pretty smart. Hell, maybe she'll like it. You'd be surprised how many of the gals I teach really get into it.
Ryan shook his head. Kathy had never once touched his shotgun, and whenever he cleaned it, kept Sally out of the room. Jack hadn't thought much about it and hadn't minded having Sally out of the way. Little kids and firearms were not a happy mixture. At home, he usually had the Remington disassembled and the ammunition locked away in the basement. How would Kathy react to having a loaded gun in the house?
What if you start carrying a gun around? How will she react to that? What if the bad guys are interested in going after them, too?
I know what you're thinking, Lieutenant, Breckenridge said.
Hey, the commander said the FBI didn't think any of this crap was gonna happen, right?
Yeah.
So what you're doing is buying insurance, okay?
He said that, too, Ryan replied.
Look, we get intel reports here, sir.
Yeah, that's right. Ever since those bike bums broke in, we get stuff from the cops and the FBI and from some other places. Even the Coast Guard. Some of their guys come here for firearms training because of the drug stuff they got them doing now.
I'll keep an ear out, too, Breckenridge assured him.
Information. It's all a battle for information. You have to know what's happening if you're going to do anything about it.
Jack turned back to look at Jackson while he made a decision that he'd been trying to avoid ever since he got back from England. He still had the number in his office. And if they tell you those bike bums are coming back, Ryan asked with a smile.
They'll wish they didn't, the sergeant major said seriously. This is a U.S. Navy reservation, guarded by the United States Marine Corps.
And that's the name of that tune, Ryan thought.
Well, thanks, Gunny. I'll get out of your way. Breckenridge saw them to the door.
1600 tomorrow, Lieutenant.
How about you, Commander Jackson?
I'll stick to missiles and cannons, Gunny. Safer that way. Good night.
Good night, sir.
Robbie walked Jack back to his office. They had to pass on the daily drinks. Jackson had to do some shopping on the way home. After his friend left, Jack stared at his telephone for several minutes. Somehow he'd managed to avoid doing this for several weeks, despite his wish to track down information on the ULA. But it wasn't just curiosity anymore. Ryan flipped open his telephone book and turned to the G page. He was able to call the D.C. area direct, though his finger hesitated before it jabbed down on each button.
"This is Mrs. Cummings," a voice answered after the first ring.
Jack took a deep breath. "Hello, Nancy. This is Dr. Ryan. Is the boss in?"
"Let me check. Can you hold for a second?"
"Yes."
They didn't have one of the new musical hold buttons there, Ryan noted. There was just the muted chirp of electronic noise for him to listen to.
"Am I doing the right thing?" he wondered. He admitted to himself that he didn't know.
"Jack," a familiar voice said.
"Hello, Admiral. How's the family?"
"Fine, thank you, sir."
"They came through all the excitement, all right?"
"Yes, sir."
"And I understand that your wife's expecting another baby. Congratulations."
"And how did you know that, Admiral?"
Ryan did not ask. He didn't have to. The DDI was supposed to know everything, and there were at least a million ways he might have found out.
"Thank you, sir."
"So, what can I do for you?"
"Admiral, I..."
Jack hesitated. "I want to look into this ULA bunch."
"Yeah, I thought you might. I have here on my desk a report from the FBI's terrorism unit about them, and we've been coordinating lately with the SIS. I'd like to see you back here, Jack. Maybe even on a more permanent basis. Have you thought our offer over any more since we last spoke?" Greer inquired innocently.
"Yes, sir, I have, but..."
"Well, I am committed to the end of the school year," Jack temporized. He didn't want to have to face that particular question. If forced, he'd just say no, and that would kill his chance to get into Langley.
"I understand. Take your time.
When do you want to come over?"
"Why are you making it so easy?"
"Could I come over tomorrow morning? My first class isn't until 2 in the afternoon."
"No problem. Be at the main gate at 8 in the morning. They'll be waiting for you. See ya."
"Goodbye, sir."
Jack hung up.
Well, that was easy.
Too easy, Jack thought.
What's he up to?
Ryan dismissed the thought. He wanted to look at what CIA had. They might have stuff the FBI didn't. At the least, he'd get a look at more data than he had now, and Jack wanted to do that. Nevertheless, the drive home was a troubled one. Jack watched his rearview mirror after remembering that he'd left the academy the same way he always did. The hell of it was he did see familiar cars. That was a problem with making your commute about the same time every day. There were at least 20 cars that he had learned to recognize. There was someone's secretary driving her Camaro Z28. She had to be a secretary. She was dressed too well to be anything else.
Then there was the young lawyer in his BMW. The car made him a lawyer, Ryan thought, wondering how he had ever assigned tags to his fellow commuters.
What if a new one shows up?
He wondered. Will you be able to tell which one is a terrorist? Fat chance, he knew. Miller, for all the danger that lay on his face, would look ordinary enough with the jacket and tie. Just another state employee fighting his way up Route 2 into Annapolis.
Paranoid. All this is paranoid, Ryan murmured to himself. Pretty soon he'd check the rear seat in his car before he got in, to see if someone might be lurking back there like on TV, with a pistol or garrote. He wondered if the whole thing might be a stupid, paranoid waste of time. What if Dan Murray just had a bug up his ass, or was simply being cautious? The Bureau probably taught its men to be cautious on these things, he was sure. Do I scare Kathy over this? What if that's all there is to it? What if it's not? That's why I'm going to go to Langley tomorrow, Ryan answered himself. They sent Sally to bed at 8:30, dressed in her bunny rabbit sleeper, the flannel pajamas with feet that keep kids warm through the night. She was getting a little old for that, Jack thought, but his wife insisted on them, since their daughter had a habit of kicking the blankets on the floor in the middle of the night. How was work today? His wife asked. The mids gave me a medal, he said, and explained on for a few minutes. Finally, he pulled the Order of the Purple Target out of his briefcase. Kathy found it amusing. The smiling stopped when he related the visit from Mr. Shaw of the FBI. Jack ran through the information, careful to include everything the agent had said. So, he doesn't really think it'll be a problem? She asked hopefully. We can't ignore it. Kathy turned away for a moment. She didn't know what to make of this new information. Of course, her husband thought. Neither do I. So, what are you going to do? She asked finally. For one thing, I'm going to call an alarm company and have the house wired. Next, I've already put my shotgun back together and it's loaded. No, Jack, not in this house. Not with Sally around, Kathy said at once. It's on the top shelf in my closet. It's loaded, but it doesn't have a round chambered. She can't possibly get to it, not even with a stool to stand on. It stays loaded, Kathy. I'm also going to start practicing some with it and maybe get a pistol, too. And he hesitated. I want you to start shooting, too. No! I'm a doctor, Jack. I don't use guns. They don't bite, Jack said patiently. I just want you to meet a guy I know who teaches women to shoot. Just meet the guy. No! Kathy was adamant. Jack took a deep breath. It would take an hour to persuade her. That was the usual time required for her common sense to overcome her prejudices. The problem was he didn't want to spend an hour on the subject right now. So you're going to call the alarm company tomorrow morning? She asked. I have to go somewhere. Where? You don't have any classes until after lunch. Ryan took a deep breath. I'm going over to Langley. What's at Langley? The CIA, Jack answered simply. What? Remember last summer? I got that consulting money from MITRE Corporation. Yeah? All the work was at CIA headquarters. But you said over in England that you never... That's where the checks came from. That's who I was working for. But CIA was where I was working at. You lied? Kathy was astounded. You lied? In a courtroom? No. I said that I was never employed by CIA, and I wasn't. But you never told me. You didn't need to know, Jack replied. I knew this wasn't a good idea. I'm your wife, damn it! What were you doing there? I was part of a team of academics. Every few years they bring in outsiders to look at some of their data, just as sort of a check on the regular people who work there. I'm not a spy or anything. I did all the work sitting at a little desk in a little room on the third floor. I wrote a report, and that was that. There was no sense in explaining the rest to her. What was the report about? I can't say. Jack! She was really mad now. Look, babe, I signed an agreement that I would never discuss the work with anybody who wasn't cleared. I gave my word, Kathy.
That calmed her down a bit. She knew that her husband was a real stickler for keeping his word. It was actually one of the things she loved about him. It annoyed her that he used this as a defense, but she knew that it was a wall she couldn't breach. She tried another tack. So why are you going back?
I want to see some information they have. You ought to be able to figure out what that information is.
About these ULA people, then?
Well, let's just say that I'm not worried about the Chinese right now.
You really are worried about them, aren't you?
She was starting to worry, finally. Yeah, I guess I am.
But why? You said the FBI said they weren't...
I don't know. Hell yes, I do know. It's that Miller bastard, the one at the trial.
He wants to kill me.
Ryan looked down at the floor. It was the first time he'd said it aloud.
How do you know that?
Because I saw his face, Kathy. I saw it, and I'm scared. Not just for me.
But Sally and I...
Do you really think he cares about that? Ryan snapped angrily.
These bastards kill people they don't even know. They almost do it for fun. They want to change the world into something they like, and they don't give a damn who's in the way. They just don't care. So why go to the CIA? Can they protect you? Us? I mean,
I want a better feel for what these guys are all about.
But the FBI knows that, don't they?
I want to see the information for myself. I did pretty well when I worked there, Jack explained. They even asked me to, well, to take a permanent position there. I turned them down.
You never told me any of this, Kathy grumped.
You know now. Jack went on for a few minutes, explaining what Shaw had told him. Kathy would have to be careful driving to and from work. She finally started smiling again. She drove a 6-cylinder bomb of a Porsche 911. Why she never got a speeding ticket was always a source of wonderment to her husband. Probably her looks didn't hurt, and maybe she flashed her Hopkins ID card with a story that she was heading to emergency surgery. However she did it, she was in a car with a top speed of over 120 miles per hour and the maneuverability of a jackrabbit. She'd been driving Porsches since her 16th birthday, and Jack admitted to himself that she knew how to make the little green sports car streak down a country road, enough to make him hold on pretty tight. This, Ryan told himself, was probably a better defense than carrying a gun. So, you think you can remember to do that?
Do I really have to?
I'm sorry I got us into this.
I never knew that anything like this would happen. Maybe I just should have stayed put.
Kathy ran her hand across his neck.
You can't change it now. Maybe they're wrong. Like you said, probably they're just acting paranoid.
Yeah.
Chapter 12. Homecoming.
Ryan left home well before 7. First, he drove to U.S. Route 50 and headed west toward D.C. The road was crowded, as usual, with the early morning commuters heading to the federal agencies that had transformed the District of Columbia from a picturesque plot of real estate into a pseudo-city of transients. He got off onto I-495, the beltway that surrounds the town, heading north through even thicker traffic whose more congested spots were reported on by a radio station's helicopter. It was nice to know why the traffic was moving at 15 miles per hour on a road designed for 70. He wondered if Kathy was doing what she was supposed to do. The problem was that there weren't that many roads for her to use to get to Baltimore. The nursery school that Sally attended was on Ritchie Highway, and that precluded use of the only direct alternate route. On the other hand, Ritchie Highway was always a crowded and fast-moving road, and intercepting her wouldn't be easy there. In Baltimore itself, she had a wide choice of routes into Hopkins, and she promised to switch them around.
Ryan looked out at the traffic in front of him and swore a silent curse. Despite what he'd told Kathy, he didn't worry overly much about his family. He was the one who'd gotten in the way of the terrorists, and if their motivation was really personal, then he was the only target. Maybe. Finally, he crossed the Potomac River and got on the George Washington Parkway. 15 minutes later, he took the CIA exit. He stopped his rabbit at the guard post.
A uniformed security officer came out and asked his name, though he'd already checked Ryan's license plate against a computer-generated list on his clipboard. Ryan handed his driver's license to the guard, who scrupulously checked the photograph against Jack's face before giving him a pass.
"Sir, the visitor's parking lot is to the left, then the second right."
"Thanks, I've been here before."
"Very well, sir."
The guard waved him on. The trees were bare. CIA headquarters was built behind the first rank of hills overlooking the Potomac Valley, in what had once been a lush forest. Most of the trees remained, to keep people from seeing the building. Jack took the first left and drove uphill on a curving road. The visitor parking lot was also attended by a guard. This one was a woman, who waved him to an open slot and made another check of Ryan before directing him toward the canopied main entrance. To his right was the bubble, an igloo-shaped theater that was connected to the building by a tunnel. He'd once delivered a talk there, a paper on naval strategy.
Before him, the CIA building was a 7-story structure of white stone, or maybe pre-stressed concrete. He'd never checked that closely. As soon as he got inside, the ambiance of Spook Central hit him like a club. He saw 8 security officers, all in civilian clothes now, their jackets unbuttoned to suggest the presence of sidearms. What they really carried was radios, but Jack was sure that men with guns were only a few feet away. The walls had cameras that fed into some central monitoring room. Ryan didn't know where that was. In fact, the only parts of the building he actually knew were the path to his erstwhile cubbyhole of an office, from there to the men's room, and the route to the cafeteria. He'd been to the top floor several times, but each time he'd been escorted, since his security pass didn't clear him for that level.
"Dr. Ryan,"
a man approached. He looked vaguely familiar, but Jack couldn't put a name on the face.
"I'm Marty Cantor. I work upstairs."
The name came back as they shook hands. Cantor was Admiral Greer's executive assistant, a preppy type from Yale. He gave Jack a security pass.
"I don't have to go through the visitor room."
Jack waved to his left.
"All taken care of. You can follow me."
Cantor led him to the first security checkpoint. He took the pass from the chain around his neck and slid it into a slot. A small gate with orange and yellow stripes, like those used for parking garages, snapped up, then down again, as Ryan stuck his card in the slot. A computer in a basement room checked the electronic code on the pass and decided that it could safely admit Ryan to the building. The gate went back up. Already Jack was uncomfortable here. Just like before, he thought. Like being in a prison. No. Security in a prison is nothing compared to this. There was something about this place that made Jack instantly paranoid.
Jack slung the pass around his neck. He gave it a quick look. It had a color photograph taken the previous year, and a number, but no name. None of the CIA passes had names on them. Cantor led off at a brisk walk to the right, then left toward the elevators. Ryan noticed the kiosk where you could buy a Coke and a Snickers bar. It was staffed by blind workers, yet another of the oddly sinister things about the CIA. Blind people were less likely to be security risks, he supposed, though he wondered how they drove into work every day. The building was surprisingly shabby, the floor tile never quite shiny, the walls a drab shade of yellow beige. Even the murals were second-rate. It surprised a lot of people that the agency spent little on the outward trappings of importance. The previous summer, Jack had learned that the people here took a perverse pride in the place's seediness. Everywhere people walked about with anonymous haste. They walked so fast in the building that most corners had hubcap-shaped mirrors to warn you of possible collision with a fellow spook, or to alert you that someone might be lurking and listening around the corner.
Why did you come here? Jack shook the thought off as he entered the elevator. Cantor pushed the button for the seventh floor. The door opened a minute later to expose yet another drab corridor. Ryan vaguely remembered the way now. Cantor turned left, then right, as Ryan watched people walking about with a speed that would impress a recruiter for the Olympic team's heel and toe crew. He had to smile at it until he realized that none of them were smiling. A serious place, the Central Intelligence Agency. The executive row of CIA had its own private corridor. This one had a rug that paralleled the main one and led to offices facing the east. As always, there were people just standing about and watching. They inspected Ryan and his pass, but showed no reaction, which was good enough news for Jack. Cantor took his charge to the proper door and opened it. Admiral James Greer was in civilian clothes, as usual, leaning back in a high-backed swivel chair, reading an inevitable folder and sipping at inevitable coffee. Ryan had never seen him otherwise. He was in his middle 60s, a tall, patrician-looking man whose voice could be as courtly or harsh as he wished. His accent was that of Maine, and for all his sophistication, Ryan knew him to be a farmer's son who'd earned his way into the Naval Academy, then spent 40 years in uniform, first as a submarine officer, then as a full-time intelligence specialist. Greer was one of the brightest people Ryan had ever met, and one of the trickiest. Jack was convinced that this gray-haired old gentleman could read minds. Surely that was part of the job description for the Deputy Director Intelligence of the Central Intelligence Agency. All the data gathered by spies and satellites, and God only knew what else, came across his desk. If Greer didn't know it, it wasn't worth knowing. He looked up after a moment. "Hello, Dr. Ryan." The Admiral rose and came over. "I see you're right on time." "Yes, sir. I remembered what a pain the commute was last summer." Without being asked, Marty Cantor got everyone coffee as they sat on chairs around a low table. One nice thing about Greer was that he always had good coffee, Jack remembered. "How's the arm, son?" the Admiral asked. "Almost normal, sir. I can tell you when it's going to rain, though. They say that may go away eventually, but it's like arthritis." "And how's your family?" The man doesn't miss a trick, Jack thought. But Jack had one of his own. "A little tense at the moment, sir. I broke the news to Kathy last night. She's not real happy about it, but then neither am I." "Let's get down to business, Admiral."
"So, what exactly can we do for you?"
Greer's demeanor changed from pleasant old gentleman to professional intelligence officer.
"Sir, I know this is asking a lot, but I'd like to see what the agency has on these ULA characters."
"Not a hell of a lot," Cantor snorted. "These boys cover their tracks like real pros. They're being bankrolled in a pretty big way. That's inferred, of course, but it has to be true." "Where does your data come from?"
Cantor looked over to Greer and got a nod. "Doctor, before we go any further, we have to talk about classification."
Resignedly.
"Yeah, what do I have to sign?"
"We'll take care of that before you leave. We'll show you just about everything we've got. What you have to know now is that this stuff is classified SI code word."
"Well, that's no surprise." Ryan sighed. Special intelligence code word was a level of classification higher than top secret. People had to be individually cleared for the data, which was identified by a special code word. Even the code word itself was secret. Ryan had only twice before seen data of this sensitivity. "But now they're going to lay it all out in front of me," he thought as he looked at Cantor. "Greer must really want me back to open a door like this."
"So, like I said, where does it come from?"
"Some from the Brits. Actually, from the PIRA via the Brits. Some new stuff from the Italians."
"Italians?" Ryan was surprised for a moment, then realized what the implications of that were.
"Oh. Okay, yeah. They have a lot of people down in Sand Dune country, don't they?"
"One of them ID'd your friend Sean Miller last week. He was getting off a certain shit that was
Miraculously enough, in the English Channel on Christmas Day, Greer said. But we don't know where he is. He and an unknown number of associates headed south, Cantor smiled. Of course, the whole country is south of the Mid, so that's not much of a help.
The FBI has everything we have, and so do the Brits, Greer said. It's not much to go on, but we do have a team sifting through it.
Thanks for letting me take a look, Admiral.
We're not doing this out of charity, Dr. Ryan, the Admiral pointed out. I'm hoping that you might find something useful. And this thing has a price for you, too. If you want in, you will be an agency employee by the end of the day. We can even arrange for you to have a federal pistol permit.
How did you know?
It's my job to know, Sonny.
The old man grinned at him. Ryan didn't think this situation was the least bit funny, but he granted the Admiral his points. When can I start?
How does your schedule look?
I can work on that, Jack said cautiously. I can be here Tuesday morning, and maybe work one full day per week, plus two half-days, in the mornings. Most of my classes are in the afternoon. Semester break is coming up, and then I can give you a full week.
Very well. You can work out the details with Marty. Go take care of the paperwork. Nice to see you again, Jack.
Jack shook his hand once more.
Thank you, sir.
Greer watched the door close before he went back to the desk. He waited a few seconds for Ryan and Cantor to clear the corridor, then walked out to the corner office that belonged to the Director of Central Intelligence.
Well, Judge Arthur Moore asked.
We got him, Greer reported.
How's the clearance procedure going?
Clean. He was a little too sharp doing his stock deals a few years back, but hell, he was supposed to be sharp.
Nothing illegal, Judge Moore asked. The agency didn't need someone who might be investigated by the SEC.
Greer shook his head.
Nah, just very smart.
Fine. But he doesn't see anything but this terrorist stuff until the clearance procedures are complete.
Okay, Arthur.
And I don't have deputy directors to do our recruiting, the DCI pointed out.
You're taking this awfully hard. Does a bottle of bourbon put that much of a dent in your bank account?
The judge laughed. The day after Miller had been sprung from British custody, Greer had made the gentlemanly wager. Moore didn't like losing at anything. He'd been a trial lawyer before becoming a jurist, but it was nice to know that his DDI had a head for prognostication.
I'm having Cantor get him a gun permit, too, Greer added.
You sure that's a good idea?
I think so.
So it's decided, then? Miller asked quietly.
O'Donnell looked over at the younger man, knowing why the plan had been formulated. It was a good plan, he admitted to himself, an effective plan. It had elements of brilliance in its daring. But Sean had allowed personal feelings to influence his judgment. That wasn't so good. He turned toward the window. The French countryside was dark, 30,000 feet below the airliner. All those peaceful people, sleeping in their homes, safe and secure. They were on a red-eye flight, and the plane was nearly empty. The stewardess dozed a few rows aft, and there was no one about to hear what they were saying. The whine of the jet engines would keep any electronic listening device from working, and they'd been very careful to cover their tracks. First the flight to Bucharest, then to Prague, then to Paris, and now the flight home to Ireland, with only French entry stamps on their passports. O'Donnell was a careful man, to the point of carrying notes on his fictitious business meetings in France. They'd get through customs easily enough, O'Donnell was sure. It was late, and the clerks at passport control were scheduled to go home right after this flight arrived.
Sean had a completely new passport, with the proper stamps, of course. His eyes were now brown, courtesy of some contact lenses. His hair changed in color and style, a neatly trimmed beard changing the shape of his face. Sean hated the beard for its itching.
O'Donnell smiled at the darkness. Well, he'd have to get used to that. Sean didn't say anything else. He sat back and pretended to read through the magazine he'd found in the seat pocket. The pretended patience was gratifying to his chief. The young man had gone through his refresher training, O'Donnell thought in military terms for this sort of thing, with a passion, trimming off the excess weight, reacquainting himself with his weapons, conferring with the intelligence officers from other fair-skinned nations, and living through their critique of the failed operation in London. These friends had not acknowledged the luck factor, and pointed out that another car of men had been needed to ensure success. Through all of it, Sean had kept his peace and listened politely. And now he waited patiently for the decision on his proposed operation. Perhaps the young man had learned something in that English jail. Yes. Ryan signed the form, acknowledging receipt of the cartful of information. He was back in the same cubbyhole office he'd had the previous summer, a windowless, closet-sized room on the third floor of CIA's main building. His desk was about the smallest size made, in federal prison workshops, for office use, and the swivel chair was a cheap one. CIA chic. The messenger stacked the documents on the corner of Ryan's desk and wheeled the cart back out of the room. Jack went to work. He took the top off a styrofoam cup of coffee bought at the kiosk around the corner, dumped in the whole container of creamer and two envelopes of sugar, and stirred it with a pencil, as he often did. It was a habit his wife loathed. The pile was about 9 inches high. The files were in oversized envelopes, each of which had an alphanumeric code stamped on in block figures. The file folders he removed from the top envelope were trimmed with red tape so as to look important. The visual cues were designed to be noticed, to stand out visually. Such files had to be locked up in secure cabinets every night, never left on a desk where someone might take an unauthorized look at them. The papers inside each were held in place with ACO fasteners, and all had numbers. The cover of the first file had its code word neatly typed on a paper label. Fidelity. Ryan knew that the code names were assigned at random by a computer, and he wondered how many such files and names there were, if the dictionary of the English language that resided in the computer's memory had been seriously depleted by the elimination of words for the thousands of secret files that sat in cabinets throughout the building. He hesitated for a moment before opening it, as though doing so would irrevocably commit him to employment at CIA, as though the first step on that path had not already been taken. Enough of that, he told himself, and opened the file. It was the first official CIA report on the ULA, barely a year old. Ulster Liberation Army, the title of the report read. Genesis of an Anomaly. Anomaly. That was the word Murray had used, Ryan remembered. The first paragraph of the report stated with disarming honesty that the information contained in the following 30 single-spaced pages was more speculation than fact, based principally on data gotten from convicted PIRA members, specifically on denials they'd made. That wasn't our operation, some of them had said after being caught for another. Ryan frowned. Not exactly the most reliable of evidence. The two men who'd done the report, however, had done a superb job of cross-referencing. The most unlikely story, heard from four separate sources, changed to something else. It was particularly true since the PIRA was, technically speaking, a professional outfit. Jack knew from his own research the previous year that the provisional wing of the Irish Republican Army was superbly organized, along the classic cellular lines. It was just like any intelligence agency. With the exception of a handful of top people, the specifics of any particular operation were compartmentalized, known only to those who really needed to know. Need to know was the catchphrase in any intelligence agency. Therefore, if the details of an operation are widely known, the report argued, it can only be because it was not a PIRA op. Otherwise they would not have known or talked about the details, even among themselves. This was twisted logic, Jack thought, but fairly convincing nonetheless. The theory held insofar as the PIRA's main rival, the less well-organized Irish National Liberation Army, the gang that had killed Lord Lewis Mountbatten, had often had its operations identified in the same way. The rivalry between PIRA and INLA had turned vicious often enough, though the latter, with its lack of internal unity and generally amateurish organization, was not nearly as effective. It was barely a year since the ULA had emerged from the shadows to take some kind of shape. For the first year they'd operated, it was thought by the British that they were a PIRA special action group, a Provo hit squad, a theory broken when a captured PIRA member had indignantly denied complicity in what had turned out to be a ULA assassination. The authors of the report then examined suspected ULA operations, pointing to operational patterns. These, Ryan saw, were quite real. For one thing, they involved more people on average than PIRA ops.
That's interesting.
Ryan walked out of the room, heading down the corridor to the kiosk where he bought a pack of cigarettes. In under a minute he was back to his office, fumbling with the cipher lock on the door.
More people per operation.
Ryan lit one of the Lotar smokes.
That was a violation of ordinary security procedures. The more people involved in an operation, the greater the risk of its being blown. What did this mean?
Ryan examined three separate operations, looking for his own patterns. It was clear after 10 minutes of examination. The ULA was more of a military organization than PIRA. Instead of the small, independent groups typical of urban terrorists, the ULA organized itself more on classic military lines. The PIRA often depended on a single cowboy assassin, less often on the special action groups. There were many cases Ryan knew of where the one designated hitter, a term popular in CIA the previous year, had his own special gun and lay in wait like a deer hunter, often for days, to kill a specific target. But the ULA was different. For one thing, they didn't generally go for individual targets. They relied, it seemed, on a reconnaissance team and an assault team that worked in close cooperation. The operative word here was seemed, Ryan read, since this again was something inferred from scanty evidence. When they did something, they usually got away cleanly. Planning and resources. Classic military lines. That implied a great deal of confidence by the ULA in its people, and in its security. Jack started making notes. The actual facts in the report were thin. He counted 6, but the analysis was interesting. The ULA showed a very high degree of professionalism in its planning and execution of operations, more so than the PIRA, which was itself proficient enough. Instead of a small number of really sharp operatives, it appeared that weapons expertise was uniform throughout the small organization. The uniformity of expertise was interesting. Military training? Ryan wrote down. How good? Where done? What source? He looked at the next report. It was dated some months after Genesis and showed a greater degree of institutional interest. CIA had begun to take a closer look at the ULA, starting 7 months previously. Right after I left here, Jack noted. Coincidence. This one concentrated on Kevin O'Donnell, the suspected leader of the ULA. The first thing Ryan saw was a photograph taken from a British intelligence gathering team. The man was fairly tall, but otherwise ordinary. The photo was dated years before, and the next thing Jack read was that the man had reportedly had plastic surgery to change his face. Jack studied the photo anyway. He'd been at a funeral for a PIRA member killed by the Ulster Defense Regiment. The face was solemn enough, with a hardness around the eyes. He wondered how much he could draw from a single photo of a man at a funeral for a comrade, and set the picture aside to read the biography of the man. A working-class background. His father had been a truck driver. His mother had died when he was 9. Catholic schools, of course. A copy of his college transcript showed him to be bright enough. O'Donnell had graduated from university with honors, and his degree was in political science. He'd taken every course on Marxism that the institution had offered, and been involved on the fringes of civil rights groups in the late 60s and early 70s. This had earned him attention from the RUC and British intelligence agencies. Then, after graduating, he'd dropped out of sight for a year, reappearing in 1972 after the Bloody Sunday fiasco, when British Army paratroopers had gotten out of control and fired into a crowd of demonstrators, killing 14 people, none of whom had been proven to have a gun.
"There's a coincidence," Ryan whispered to himself.
The paratroopers still claimed that they'd been fired upon from someone in the crowd and merely returned fire to defend themselves. An official government report done by the British backed this up.
Of course. What else could they say?
Ryan shrugged.
It might even have been true.
The biggest mistake the English had ever made was to send troops into Northern Ireland. What they'd needed was good cops to re-establish law and order, not an army of occupation. But with the RUC out of control then, and supplemented by the B-Special thugs, there hadn't been a real alternative.
So soldiers had been sent in to a situation for which they were unsuited by training and vulnerable to provocation. Ryan's antennae twitched at that. Political science major. Heavy course load in Marxism. O'Donnell had dropped out of sight, then reappeared about a year later, immediately after the Bloody Sunday disaster, and soon thereafter was identified by an informer as the PIRA's chief of internal security. He didn't get that job on the basis of college classwork. He'd had to work to earn that. Terrorism, like any other profession, had its apprenticeship. Somehow this Kevin Joseph O'Donnell had earned his spurs. How did you do that? Were you one of the guys who stage-managed the provocations? If so, where did you learn how? And does that missing year have anything to do with it? Were you trained in urban insurgency tactics? In the Crimea, maybe.
Too much of a coincidence, Jack told himself. The idea of Soviet training for the hardcore members of the PIRA and INLA had been bandied about so much that it had lost credibility. Besides, it didn't have to be something that dramatic. They might just have figured out the proper tactics for themselves, or read them in books. There were plenty of books on the subject of how to be an urban guerrilla. Jack had read several of them. He flipped forward in time to O'Donnell's second disappearance. Here the information from British sources was fairly complete for once. O'Donnell had been remarkably effective as chief of internal security. Nearly half the people he'd killed really had been informers of one sort or another. Not a bad percentage in this sort of business. He found a couple of new pages at the end of the report, and read the information that David Ashley had gathered a few months before in Dublin. He got a little carried away. O'Donnell had used his position to eliminate provos whose politics didn't quite agree with his. It had been discovered, and he'd vanished for a second time. Again, the data was speculative, but it tracked with what Murray had told him in London. O'Donnell had gone somewhere. Surely he'd convinced someone to provide his nascent organization with financing, training, and support. His nascent organization, Ryan thought. Where had it come from? There was a lapse of 2 years before O'Donnell's disappearance from Ulster and the first positively identified operation of the ULA. 2 complete years. The Brit intel data suggested plastic surgery. Where? Who paid for it? He didn't do that in some jerkwater third world country, Ryan told himself. He wondered if Kathy could ask her colleagues at Hopkins about the availability of good face cutters. 2 years to change his face, get financial backing, recruit his troops, establish a base of operations, and begin to make his impact. Not bad, Ryan thought with grudging admiration. All that in 2 years. Another year before the name of the outfit surfaces. Ryan turned when he heard someone working the lock on his office door. It was Marty Cantor.
I thought you stopped smoking.
He pointed at the cigarette. Ryan crushed it out.
So does my wife.
Have you seen all this stuff?